The following program is pre-recorded.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. More than half of Wisconsin's child care providers are operating below capacity. That's according to a new report from the State Department of Children and Families. A common reason for that? Not enough staff.
And the child care search site Winnie says Wisconsin families pay on average about 14% of their income to child care. That's roughly double the recommended average of 7%.
We're taking a look at the double bind in the child care field, how to pay enough to bring staff on board while not getting too expensive for parents to afford. Paula Drew directs early care and education policy and research for the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. Paula, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
All right. This report, Paula, from the Department of Children and Families finds providers could care for 30,000 more children if they filled unused capacity. What are the challenges for these child care providers reaching their full, at least theoretical, capacity for the number of kids they take care of?
Yeah, so I think you hit the nail on the head already. It's a staffing issue, and it's ultimately a revenue issue. The sector primarily operates on parent fees. As you also mentioned, parents are paying about as much as they possibly can already, and it's not enough. It's a broken market system. Our calculations point to about needing 4,000 more teachers to fill that gap, to fill those seats that are open right now.
And a quandary here is to bring in these trained teachers. You have to pay them, of course, and there's a double bind. You ought to pay them enough to bring them in, but as I mentioned, not price parents out of the market. Are we anywhere near that, or is this something that isn't going to solve itself without some kind of outside help?
We believe that this will not be solved without outside help. I think parents cannot pay more, and we're seeing providers close because they cannot fill those financial gaps. And you're right, the average wage for an educator, you know, is about half as much as the average Wisconsin worker makes. So if you can work down the street at a Quick Trip or a McDonald's and make more and probably get benefits, you're likely going to make that choice for your own family. And that's why our classrooms are going unfilled. It's not something that can't be solved without public funding. And, you know, I think it's interesting that children are born learning, right? Their brains are more active in their development up until the age of five, yet we don't start funding education until children are four or five. And it's time Wisconsin starts investing in our youngest citizens.
Let's get a firsthand perspective now. Corrine Hendrickson is a family child care provider based in New Glarus. She operates Corrine's Little Explorers and provides preschool services, full-time child care, and education. Corrine, thanks a lot for joining us, I believe, from your preschool right now.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. I do have a substitute, so she's with the children at the moment.
Thank you for letting us know. I think people would have wondered. That is great to know. Now, Corrine, we've been talking with Paula here about these staffing challenges. Is this something that you see, this difficulty being able to draw in maybe as many child care workers as you'd like to?
Yes, definitely. So for myself as a family child care professional, the very first time we ever received any sort of other revenue besides that was above and beyond what we charge for tuition, besides very few things, was during COVID pandemic. And that was the very first time that my household family income was stabilized. That was the first time that I could buy my kids their clothes when they needed them, instead of trying to figure, okay, how can I play this game so I can go get their clothes and pay the bill off next month? And so that was huge. And the reason that that's never happened was because, as Paula was saying, I cannot charge enough tuition to pay myself a decent wage. For all the hours I work and, you know, with the children, I'm with kids for 50 hours. That's another piece people forget. We have to care for the children while their parents are commuting and have lunch breaks. And so they're in care for about 10 hours a day. And we need to be able to pay ourselves and our teachers that much. And so this last year, after we lost the federal funding and our state refused to continue it in the budget with our state funds, I had incrementally raised my rates. They're $70 more a week than they were a year ago. I am pricing out of families. I have never had problems filling my slots before, But this year, it was the week before September 1st when I had three openings that got filled that week. And that was frightening because then I was looking at, well, if I can't operate with only five children, I won't be able to pay my bills. So I started looking for other jobs because I couldn't, you know, I can't justify putting my family into bankruptcy or losing my home if I can't fill spots. And I had several people looking and several people asking, but I would send them my contract and rates, and they were like, I can't pay that. It's too much. And so even my child on subsidy, she pays half of my tuition because our subsidy is so poor in this state that we are not meeting the financial obligations that we have set out when we take the federal money for that. And so it's affecting everyone, our lowest income, our middle income. The only people that are left that really can afford quality care are those who are in the higher socioeconomic status. And so we need that public investment to help offset that. All the other countries around us do it, you know, more and more investing more and more because they're understanding it's the brain development, it's that caring, nurturing relationship. Smaller group sizes are what we need so that we can meet these kids' needs, especially as more and more are having special needs. And they should be included in our programs, but we can't support them if we don't have the lower ratios or the high quality teachers to do that.
And Paula, Corrine mentioned, you know, she's basically on the edge here of being able to stay open as a business. We know from the Department of Children and Families, nearly 80 providers closed up last month. How common is it that we're seeing people in maybe Corrine's position saying, you know what, I love this work, but it just doesn't work anymore?
I hear that same story almost every day, Rob. And honestly, I was not surprised at all when I read this report. But, you know, what visually I was imagining while reading it was sort of like a store with a bunch of empty shelves or a shopping mall in decline. Like, we knew this was going to happen. Childcare providers have been sounding this alarm for some time. And as, you know, as Corrine was saying, as these childcare accounts payments are reduced, this is exactly what's happening. The world is not as it was before COVID. And even then, the private market for childcare didn't work. And now it's absolutely broken. We can see, you know, this direct link between maternal workforce participation and the supply of childcare. And Wisconsin now is seeing its lowest women's workforce participation since the 80s. So as we have a decline in childcare that's available and affordable, less women are entering and staying in the workforce, and that is costing the state probably as much money as it would cost to just invest in the early care and education sector.
We are talking about difficulties facing childcare in Wisconsin after a new report showing a lot of capacity at childcare centers. Not for good reasons, because they can't find enough staff or because costs are high enough, as we're hearing, to say parents can't afford it. We've got Paula Drew with the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association with us. Corrine Hendrickson, operator of Corrine's Little Explorers in New Glarus. Corrine, another challenge that came out of this report is unpredictability of when parents are going to need help. So family A might need 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. every week, every weekday. Parent B might need only holidays and days off. Another one might have an unpredictable schedule. Their needs vary from day to day. Is this a challenge when it comes to scheduling and staffing a child care?
Yes, absolutely. As more and more people have more flexible work options or are basically going into their employers and saying, look, I can only afford to pay for childcare 3 days a week. So I'm only working, you know, 3 days a week. But then they're coming to us and we can't fill that whole slot because what happens is that parent isn't needing the consistent day. So let's say they work as a nurse and their shift isn't every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. It varies throughout the week. And so that child still has to have a full-time spot because we can't fill the other spots in consistently. And we can't be over ratio for good reason, the health and safety of these children. Also, young children really need consistency of care. And so those of us who do accept part-time, we would like the days to be in a row because that's what's best and best for the children and their development. And so that's part of an issue too, because, you know, it's really difficult for us to communicate that to parents and for them to understand, but I only need these days this week and these days this week. I'm like, but how do I fill in the other days so that I can operate fully, maintain, you know, my revenue that I need to maintain, but then also make it so that you can spend time with your own child, because that's also part of why people are wanting to do, you know, more part-time work or flexible scheduling, because they want to be able to spend more time with their children during these years. So we really need to be looking at how we invest as, you know, not necessarily a per child, or because I don't like to call it slots, per child. Sorry, I have a child in the bathroom.
That's fine.
and so we really need to look at, what does this program need to operate? How much do they need for their basic program, you know, the building, the utilities, the food? How much do they need to pay their employees a livable wage and benefits? Because that's another thing we're finding is family childcare in Wisconsin, the average age is like 54. A lot of our people have been doing this for a long time. They're 70, they're almost 80, and they can't retire because they have no retirement. And so we are asking people to work almost until they die in this field. And that's not fair. And that's not something that we as a society should be expecting of anyone. And so we really need to look at this holistically and look at, we need to create a system that works for the parents, that works for the children, and works for our community, so that our employers have the available workforce that they need right now. And then also in the future, we're building these brains. 90% of that brain development happens in these early years, and it's relationship and it's one-on-one and trusting, caring environments. And so that is making the workforce for tomorrow. And that reduces costs for K-12. It reduces crime. You want to reduce crime? Invest in early childhood. It is like the easiest way to do it. And there's police officer groups that are getting more and more vocal. Invest in kids, not crime, is one of them. And they're really coming back and saying, look, all of these things come back to our broken communities and our broken childcare system.
And we'll leave it there. Corrine, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And Paula, thanks for being with us.
Absolutely.
We've been talking about childcare in Wisconsin with Paula Drew, who directs early care and education policy and research for the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association, and Corrine Hendrickson, family childcare provider based in New Glarus. She operates Corrine's Little Explorers and provides preschool services and full-time childcare and education. Is this the story of your life we're talking about right now, whether you provide childcare or as a family, you need it? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a Baraboo native helps mothers like her lead a life without alcohol.
Chances are you felt alone in your drinking. You don't have to feel alone in your sobriety. Seek out community.
Meet the host of the podcast called The Sober Mom Life. That's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The question of how much alcohol is too much is at the center of a debate between health officials and lawmakers on Capitol Hill. Federal agencies are preparing to update their guidelines on alcohol consumption next year.
But outside the circles of government agencies, lawmakers, the alcohol industry, is a Baraboo native who speaks directly to other moms about how to live a sober life.
Suzanne Wareye is 4 years sober. As a podcast host and lifestyle influencer, Wareye makes glamorizing sobriety her mission.
A recent podcast episode explores what Wareye calls the magical side of sobriety and gives strategies on how to avoid drinking alcohol in the summer.
Suzanne Wareye hosts the Sober Mom Life podcast and runs the sobriety and style blog called My Kind of Sweet. Suzanne, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, thank you. I'm so excited to be back.
Well, take us back to your childhood in Wisconsin growing up. Can you talk about what it was like and your connection to alcohol?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the running joke on the Sober Mom Life podcast is that everyone says, you know, I know you think that you drink a lot in your area, but in my state, we drink a lot. And I just have to say,
No, for real. In Wisconsin, we drank a lot. My drinking started in high school. It wasn't anything crazy at that point. It was just kind of maybe on the weekends. And college, I went to college in Green Bay, Wisconsin, which is it was just rated the drunkest city in the United States, which I think is pretty wild. And it was a lot of binge drinking, you know. It was drinking on the weekends. It was Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then recovery on Sunday. And it wasn't anything out of the ordinary. It was very in line with, you know, what my friends were doing and what everyone was doing. I think that it is a way of life in Wisconsin. It has been. And I definitely fell into that growing up.
That could be tough to hear, that it's a way of life, because it can be so dangerous.
Yeah.
When did you realize that this was problematic, that you couldn't do this?
So my story is a little bit different. And my take on sobriety is different, because while I did spend really my 20s binge drinking, and I did not like that. I really never loved my relationship with alcohol. When I had kids and I got married, had kids, and then in motherhood, I really was able to moderate. So my story is not one of rock bottom where there are flashing red lights. I lost everything to alcohol. I was, you know, there was no intervention, there was no rehab. I really was able to moderate. It from the outside, it looked like everything was fine. And I wouldn't think that anyone would really call alcohol a problem in my life. It didn't interfere with my day-to-day. I didn't drink it every day. But still, I hated it. And I hated how exhausting moderation was. I hated the mental games that I had to play. And it wasn't until I stopped in January 2020 that I realized that if alcohol is in my life, if I'm going to have a relationship with it, it's going to require some work, no matter what. I mean, and that's what I have found after talking to hundreds and hundreds of women, is true for everyone. And so then I started kind of zooming out from this idea that in order to qualify for a full life of sobriety, a full life without alcohol, that we have to wait until we lose everything, until it hinders us every day, until we're forced to stop. And so now my whole mission is to catch women before it gets to that problem, and just to see alcohol for what it is, as a problem, as a highly addictive, mind-altering substance, rather than saying, well, I'm not that bad, and you can't see me, but I'm using really big quotes, air quotes. I'm not that bad, right? Because the fact is that alcohol is that bad, and I could have waited to lose more than my memories on one night. And it just hit me on that morning that I wasn't willing to do that anymore, that I had given alcohol a lot of excuses, like decades of excuses. And I didn't want to do it anymore. And so that's kind of my story of getting off the downward slope before it really happened.
There's this one podcast episode I was listening to where you're describing just this picturesque, you know, summer evening, near summer evening, and then thinking, well, I could go inside and have a drink, but I would miss this. I would miss being around my kids, out running around in the yard and this peaceful time. And I could just picture it. And I think maybe that is that mental struggle you might be referring to.
Yes, exactly. And I just didn't know how much brain power and how much room alcohol was taking up in my brain until I removed it, until it was off the table. It was not at all a part of my life. And then only then did I realize, oh my God, this is when I would have missed this. I would have missed these small moments. And I'm not talking about a blackout. I'm not talking about a brownout. I'm just talking about when our focus is on alcohol, which if it's in the equation, if it's invited in, generally that's the case. And I know that because we are a society obsessed with alcohol. You know, it's a billion-dollar industry, and its presence at, you know, a baby's first birthday would, or a baby shower would show us how obsessed we are with alcohol. And so we've just been taught and we've been tricked into thinking that only some people qualify for a full life without alcohol. And if you're not that, then you just have to make it work and you just have to drink better. And if your mind is altered by a mind-altering substance, it's something you're doing. It's a weakness in you. And that's a lie. I mean, that's part of the big trick that, big alcohol is very, very invested in making sure we continue to believe that the onus is on us, that we have to just control this substance better. And it's a lie.
Suzanne, why mothers? What are some of the unique challenges that moms face when it comes to alcohol?
So I love that you brought this up. I am a mom of three. And what I quit drinking just a month before the pandemic. And since then, what I have learned is specifically mothers, especially after the pandemic. We have felt more alone than ever, not only in motherhood, but also in our drinking. And coupled with that, we are targeted now more than ever. You know, the pink wine bottles and the seltzers and the feminization of alcohol isn't an accident. They're targeting moms and they're saying, hey, do you remember when you used to be carefree before you became moms? You can have that again. You know, it's right up in line with the Virginia Slims, you've come a long way, baby, female empowerment. Women are in the crosshairs of big alcohol and specifically moms. And I, you know, women and moms have been taught from the beginning to be quiet about the things that scare us and the things that we feel alone in. An example is in early pregnancy when we're taught not to talk about, you know, don't share it unless in case something happens, right? Yeah. We need community, especially if something happens. We don't have the communities that we once had. Moms are feeling alone. They're feeling pressured. I never, ever shame moms who drink because moms drinking is just a sign that we need help. Moms are drinking to cope, to escape, to numb. What we know is that it doesn't work. Alcohol doesn't help with those things. It actually makes anxiety worse. It can cause depression. It leads to cancer. And it's highly addictive. And so if we can start just talking, I always say it just starts with talking. You can come and join our community and you can still be drinking. You don't have to be sober to join the Sober Mom Life Cafe. That's the community I created for moms. Moms need a place where we can talk honestly about our relationship with alcohol and all of the doubts that we have harbored all of this time, the shame that we feel that we're not able to drink like quote unquote normal people who that's not a thing. And we need a place where we can come together as moms and say, you're not alone. I have felt that too. Keep talking, keep sharing, and we can do this together. And that is what I've created. And it's the best. I mean, it's the highlight of my week is when I get to sit down. We have meetings every day, but I host one every Friday. And when I get to sit down with those moms and we just get to talk, just talk about the real stuff that moms face today and remind each other that alcohol only makes it harder.
You have three kids. Have you thought about how you will communicate these types of feelings and messages to them, especially with your own upbringing in Wisconsin in the back of your mind?
Yes, I think about that all the time. You know, it's a little bit different for me since I'm a sobriety influencer and they hear me talk about alcohol. They see me write about it. They hear it all the time. But I, you know, thinking about how I grew up and that alcohol really was not discussed, I don't blame my parents for that. I think they were doing the best they can. It wasn't a topic of conversation. And I always say, you know, you don't have to villainize alcohol. You just have to tell the truth. And that goes a long way. We start by telling the truth about what alcohol is, what it does to our brain and our bodies and our mental health, and how addictive it is. And when our kids maybe have seen us drink or have seen us tipsy or seen us drunk, it's really important to acknowledge that what they saw was true, that it was too much alcohol. It wasn't just mommy was acting silly. It was, you know, mommy made a bad choice, which we all do. We all make bad choices. And the alcohol affected mommy in this way. And there's no spin there. There's no lie. There's no gaslighting. There's no tricking. It's just this honest, ongoing conversation. I also think, you know, my favorite part about sobriety is that it leads me to know not only how I feel, but what I need. And by showing my kids that, by giving them the language of, I'm feeling frustrated, I need 5 minutes. They echo that. It is the, you know, say less, do more. And they're seeing how to live a life without alcohol.
Suzanne, you know, in closing here, as people hear your message, hear your stories, and engage with you on sobriety, what would you tell people who deeply want to quit drinking but are really feeling lost, feeling like they don't know where to start?
I would say, first of all, I'm so proud of you. I think opening your eyes to something that we've been taught to close our eyes to is very brave, and you can do it. I would say, can you do it alone? Yes, but you don't have to. Chances are you felt alone in your drinking. You don't have to feel alone in your sobriety. Seek out community. Find a community that is without shame, without judgment. And it starts with curiosity. I think that we can really fall into the trap of pass, fail, day one, I can't get this, I can't. And that's, you know, if the goal is long-term change, which it is here, it's a journey. And it's not this, it's not a day one situation. We don't use that kind of language. We don't call ourselves alcoholics. It's long-term change. And it just starts. It starts by telling the truth. And if you can do that in a safe space without judgment with women or men who understand you, that's where it starts. And then if you just continue to slowly tell the truth about your relationship with alcohol, about how it's affected you, it makes it very hard to romanticize that, you know, that glass of red wine or in Wisconsin, that, you know, New Glarus, I don't know, beer. Spotted cow.
There we go.
Yeah.
Oh, Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Suzanne Wareye hosts a podcast called The Sober Mom Life and runs a sobriety and style blog, My Kind of Sweet. She talked with us about her personal journey to sobriety. Now we wanted to learn more about access to alcohol in Wisconsin, so we called up Maureen Busalaki. She directs the new Division of Alcohol Policy Prevention and Research at the Medical College of Wisconsin's Comprehensive Injury Center. Here's what Busalaki told us.
So one of the issues that we have here in Wisconsin is that we have so many outlets. So we're talking about gas stations, liquor stores, grocery stores, bars and restaurants. I had a bakery down the street that sold beer as well, which seems to me kind of unusual. But so the number of outlets is much higher here. So we have one for 355 people. New Jersey, the average is one per 3,000 people. So other states really regulate this much differently than we do here in Wisconsin.
Busalaki also wants stricter enforcement at the checkout line. She says that stores selling alcohol need to do better at checking IDs so underage youth don't walk out with an alcohol purchase.
Drinking can delay adolescence. It can delay, brain development. It has a number of issues in terms of social and academic impacts that it can have on our young people. So it's really important to make sure that we're talking to our kids about alcohol and that we're making sure it's not available. One piece we're really pushing is alcohol age compliance checks. It's been proven to reduce fatalities with our young people and motor vehicles. And it's also an important kind of experience that if a child goes and tries to buy alcohol, that they are not allowed to get that alcohol because the retailer says no. And in Wisconsin, we don't pay to have alcohol age compliance checks. So it's spotty across the state where these are done. Yeah. When a community gets started, we find the sales going to youth are very high. Up to 75% of those kids are able to sell. And that's problematic. So we're working with law enforcement and many other partners and coalitions and public health, Department of Transportation and others to help expand the amount of alcohol age compliance checks that are happening and that they keep doing them on a regular basis to make sure that our retailers are following the law.
And on a national level, Busalaki says the federal health guidelines on how much alcohol is safe to drink should reflect the latest science.
The research over the last decade or so has shown that our guidelines may be too high to avoid chronic health issues such as cancer and cardiovascular disease. We also have a lot more information about the number of injuries caused by excessive alcohol use. So by reducing how much people are drinking and having an understanding of what a serving size is and what kind of harm can come from alcohol, this would be an important change that we could make in the U.S.
That was Maureen Busalaki from the Medical College of Wisconsin's Comprehensive Injury Center. Earlier, we talked with the host of the Sober Mom Life podcast, Suzanne Wareye. If you or someone you know is dealing with addiction, there is help. Call the free and confidential treatment referral hotline. That number is 800-662-HELP.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, author Joyce Carol Oates joins the show to talk about her time in Wisconsin, her latest novel, and why she writes in different styles and genres.
As a writer, I really feel I'd like to experiment.
Joyce Carol Oates coming up on WPR News.
Celebrate traditions old and new this holiday season with special programs all this month. Hi, I'm Sarah Ashworth, director of WPR. Find beautiful music, friendly conversation, and engaging entertainment to keep you company at home, at work, and on the go. Explore the full schedule of seasonal programs at wpr.org/holidays, and thanks for listening.
Support for WPR comes from Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, offering bird food, feeders, and nature gifts for all occasions. Located at 8402 Old Sauk Road, Madison. Discover a refuge in your own backyard. Wisconsin Public Radio brings the state together. With reports from our 8 bureaus around the state and conversations about topics that matter to you, WPR is your connection to the pulse of Wisconsin. We are your source for in-depth news from Wisconsin, the U.S., and the world.
This is WPR News.
This is Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Joyce Carol Oates is one of the most prolific and eclectic authors in the U.S. book world. She's published more than 100 books, including novels, short story collections, poetry, plays, essays, and children's literature.
Oates earned her master's degree from UW-Madison in 1961, and since then, she's had a long list of career milestones and honors, including the National Book Award and the National Humanities Medal, and she has been nominated several times for the Pulitzer Prize.
Her latest novel, Butcher, is a literary horror inspired by real-life medical experiments performed on women in the 19th century with a main character based on three historical doctors. I talked to Joyce Carol Oates last week about her new book and how her time in Wisconsin influenced her life and career. Joyce, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Your new novel, Butcher, is about a 19th century doctor who performs really horrific experimental procedures on women at an asylum where he's the medical director eventually. Can you talk about why you tackled this subject matter in your newest novel and why now?
I have really long been interested in scientific misconduct and in the history of medicine, history of science. My late husband, Charlie Gross, was a neuroscientist with an interest also in a history of medicine. And the history of medical science is very fascinating. It throws a good deal of light on how people view one another today, especially in a patriarchal culture, how physicians and surgeons viewed women, and how mental illness in women was treated often with hysterectomies and other surgeries that related to a person being a woman.
Your main character, Silas Weir, is based on some real doctors from the 1800s, including one with a very similar name. Can you talk about the research and the sorts of things you found, again, horrific things you found about some of these treatments and experiments?
Oh, yes. Well, it's quite fascinating. I think everyone really has an interest in the history of a developing field like medicine. Of course, the early surgeries were experimental. You can imagine during the Civil War when legs were being amputated and many things were being done that had actually never been done before. So, too, in my novel, in the 1830s, the doctors and research scientists were experimenting in many ways that seemed brutal and insane to us today, but at the time they were sort of blundering. Now, Dr. Weir, Silas Weir, my character, is a composite figure. There are really three doctors who are also sort of research scientists who go into the composite figure. And one of them is Dr. Weir Mitchell. He was very prominent, extremely famous in the 19th century for his theories about how women should be treated. And then J. Marion Sims is still known as the father of modern gynecology. And, of course, he's notorious for having operated especially on black enslaved women in great numbers and always without any anesthesia. But the one who interests me the most, because I live in Princeton, not far away from Trenton, is Dr. Henry Cotton. He was the director of the New Jersey State Lunatic Asylum in Trenton, and that isn't very far away from where I'm actually sitting. Mm. So by looking into the lives of these three men, I created a composite figure who seems to me very realistic. He behaves and thinks in ways that are very plausible. It was also very common that men like him considered themselves Christians, and they considered what they were doing in some way related to God's will be done.
You mentioned a patriarchal society, and it really shines through in the book, this research being done and these experimental surgeries being done by men very condescending toward women, contemptuous of women, especially of lower social class, no interest in the consent of the people they're operating on. And what really strikes me, Joyce, is this is the foundation of modern gynecology. This is the foundation of the medical treatment of women. Do you feel like maybe not as bad as it was then, but that some of these attitudes lingered on long after?
Well, that's very true. As far back as Aristotle, it was considered that women were second-class citizens, that they were really a little bit subhuman compared to men, and that if a woman was upset about something, it could be like her role in life. She might not want to get married or have children. It was considered hysteria. Men could not be hysterical because hysteria derived from the uterus. The female reproductive organs were often removed.
We're talking to Joyce Carol Oates about her new novel. It's called Butcher, and about her time as a student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Joyce, I want to turn to your time in Madison. I would love to say it was a wonderful experience and reminisce about those times, but you wrote in your memoir, in the academic department you're in the English department, this was in some ways a lost time for you. Can you talk about your experience at UW?
Well, I think I may overstated. I came from Syracuse University, where the professors were extremely, I guess, just younger, and they were more focused on new literature and American literature. When I came to Wisconsin, most of the faculty was older. They were from Harvard, and they were teaching in a way that is now not fashionable. They just lectured. Sometimes they just lectured from notes, and there wasn't much close reading of texts, which we did at Syracuse. Today, it's very rare in an English class that a professor just lectures. In my classes, we're all reading the literature and, you know, discussing and talking about it much more lively. So when I went to Wisconsin, I was sort of thrown back into an older mode of pedagogy. I remember one professor just sat and read from his own book. He had written a book on the American Puritans, and he just sat and read from his own book. You know, and we were taking notes, but the whole thing was very stultifying. It was very dull. I did have one wonderful professor, Helen White. She taught the English ballad. She taught medieval literature, and I think she was able to make it come more alive. I have very good memories of Helen White.
There's a library not far from where I'm sitting named after her now. Joyce, as a young woman, these were, apart from Helen White, I gather mostly older men. And you talked, I think, in your memoir about, you know, getting married and them saying, well, a married woman academic. Was this just old-fashioned sexism part of what you encountered, a part of that negative experience?
Well, I think it was, absolutely. Yes. If I had it to do all over again, I probably would be able to navigate it a little better. I may have been just kind of naive. I mean, I had come from Syracuse, where I was very respectful of me, and I think of other women students as well. But then when I came to Wisconsin, as I said, it was really more of an older patriarchy, and I probably just didn't know how to deal with that. It was just sort of not the right place for me. In a way, I can't believe, to quote Bob Dylan, sure is glad to get out of there alive.
Now, this is a weird sequence, Joyce. I read this passage from your memoir right before I read The Butcher, and you have a scene in your memoir where you're being effectively judged, right, by the committee that says, do you get to go on and do your dissertation or not? They end up saying no. And I don't know, this idea of a condescending group of older men set in their ways, deciding a woman's future, and then reading The Butcher, my brain is connecting dots there. Should it be?
Well, that is very interesting. I remember that so well, but it was in a way a blessing. I didn't have any intention of going on for a PhD. Now, if they had said to me, oh, Joyce, you are just what we want. You're going to be like Helen White. You have to get a PhD, and we'll give you a fellowship. that would have maybe ruined my life because I would have toiled away in the library doing this historical research and talking about sources. And my life would have been really sabotaged. So as it turned out, there's a medieval concept of the fortunate fall, the wheel of fortune. But the fortunate fall is supposedly Adam and Eve. It was the fall of man. But then that brought Jesus into the world. So the Christian idea is that there was a fortunate fall. And in our lives, too. I mean, more than once in my life, there has been a fortunate failure at just the right time. So it cut off a road I might have been following that would not have been good.
Do you have other fond memories, Joyce, of your couple years in Wisconsin?
Oh, yes, I have many, many fond memories. I liked Wisconsin very much. I was very happy in Madison. I love the city. Just the right size. I love the lake, the student union, that wonderful student union. My husband, Ray Smith, and I spent so many wonderful times there. We walked all around. We walked out through the agricultural college. We rented an apartment way out University Avenue, I think, or State Street. I can't remember the name, but it was way out. So we walked about a mile to class. I shouldn't just focus on the very end of my my experience there, because the oral exam at the very end of the spring term was really a very small part of my life. I can remember very, very well walking around Madison University, that high hill, the long hill. I was really overall extremely happy there.
I know you get asked this a lot about your prolific nature as an author. You've written lots and lots of books. But interestingly, you know, I think some authors crank books out because they have a formula. It's always the same book with some variations. That is very much not what you're doing. Can you talk about not just the quantity of books you put out, but the range of subject matter and even styles and genres you've tackled?
Well, thank you for that question, because as a writer, I really feel I like to experiment. So writing about the butcher, the doctor, I could have written it in the third person, where we see him do this and we see him do that. I wanted to write about him from the point of view of the first person. Basically, he is telling his own story, and he incriminates himself all the time. He's so vain and blind, and he's comical.
Now, Joyce, I wanted to ask you, this is, again, your latest novel. You've written many. You are, I hope you don't mind me saying, well into your 80s. I hope to be in my 80s someday, and I hope to still have some kind of creative spark. Do you have advice, or what has kept you motivated to keep on creating?
Well, it's really just the opposite. I don't have enough time to do all the things that I want to do. I have many, many outlines for a couple of novels and stories, all sorts of notes. I have too many ideas, really.
And before we let you go, Joyce, I know you have a number of projects maybe in mind. Is there one that's at the front of the pack that might emerge as your next novel?
Well, my next novel is an experiment as a whodunit. I've never written in that genre where it's a mystery. There's a body, in this case a dismembered body, of a person. We learn about who he is, and we learn about the community. The man's name is Mr. Fox. He's a very popular middle school teacher, and first he goes missing, then his body is found, and then we sort of move through an investigation with a real detective, so a real police investigation. So I had a lot of fun writing a police procedural. I love to read police procedurals, but I've never written one before.
I would read a Joyce Carol Oates police procedural.
Thank you. Well, it's all very realistic. This is not, I mean, Butcher goes into the surreal a little bit. Fox is all realistic. It's set in a realistic place. And the police investigation is very realistic. And there is a revelation at the end. You do find out who the murderer is. It's not an elliptical literary postmodernist novel that has no resolution. It's a genre novel with an actual ending. So I wanted to write about that in a literary way and sort of use, unusual sentences and vocabulary. But I wanted to have that genre structure.
Joyce, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Very nice to talk to you.
That was Joyce Carol Oates, author of more than 100 books, the recipient of honors including the National Book Award and the National Humanities Medal. She got her master's from UW-Madison. She joined us to talk about her most recent novel, Butcher, her upcoming police procedural, and her time in Wisconsin. Last week, Larry Mueller invited you to tell us about your favorite books that you read in 2024 and shared some book suggestions for WPR staff.
You can read up on those suggestions at our website at WPR.org.
And there's still time for you to join in. What was your best read of 2024, whether it was a new book, an old classic, or somewhere in between?
Is there a book that you've given or received as a gift?
Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@WPR.org, or you can call 888-642-0232 to share your best reads of 2024.
Happy reading! Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.